Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Happy Good Friday. I'm Charlie Sykes. We wake up this morning, the day after this massive job loss. Hard to get your head around the fact that 17 million jobs have been vaporized in the last 3 weeks. As of now, about nearly 17,000 Americans have died from the coronavirus in the United States. There are roughly a half million confirmed cases. And the president is once again back to talking about opening up the country very, very quickly. So we have a lot going on. They have the headline in the Washington Post is Trump seeks to reopen much of the U.S. next month. A lot of medical experts are saying, look, we're not ready for all of that. I think part of the irony is the success of the efforts that we've made now are being used as a pretext to stop using those methods. People who are saying, well, look, the fact that they were lowering the estimates of the number of Americans dying means that we overreacted, that we didn't need to do any of the things that we did. But of course, that's the opposite of the case, that we wouldn't be lowering the estimates if we weren't doing these things. Okay, so to sort through all of this, we have a special guest, first time appearance on the Bulwark Podcast, Windsor Mann, who's a member of the USA Today Board of Contributors. He's a contributor of the week. He's the editor of the Quotable Hitchens. He has a piece coming out about Donald Trump and authoritarianism in the LA Times. And he is one of the grand masters of the Twitter aphorism. How about that for an introduction, Windsor?
I approve. I think you nailed it. You forgot to say handsome, but other than that, it's pretty good.
Well, we're doing a podcast, so I don't know whether you're handsome or not. I'll have to take your word for it. I mean, there's okay. There's a picture on your Twitter account, but I don't, you know, is that you?
No, that's some random guy. It's just some random person.
It could be QAnon or something like that. So, Windsor, I'm a big fan of yours because you really are the master of the aphorism in the age of Trump. And obviously you like words. And that's a silly way to put it. But I do think that every once in a while, it's valuable to just come up with a formulation to understand Trump's mind. You know, like, for example, just yesterday, well, the day before, you tweeted out, the only time Trump opposes fraud is when he doesn't do it. or a couple of days ago, when Trump says he knows everything, he knows nothing. You have a series like that, don't you?
Yeah. I was actually plagiarizing myself on that one. I tweeted something before after he said after Trump said he didn't know Les, what was his name? Parnov?
Lev
was that
Parnov.
Guy's last name?
Les.
But yeah. Trump said there's a series of associates that Trump has claimed he didn't know. And so I just thought of, it's so rare when Trump says he doesn't know something. And because he claims to know everything about windmills and technology and drones and the economy and ISIS and everything. So it's all those things he clearly doesn't know anything about. So I just thought, okay, when he says he knows everything, he knows nothing. And then when he says he knows nothing, it means he knows something. And that something is bad. So he's always covering something up. It's either he's covering up his lack of knowledge or he's covering up his guilty knowledge. It's one of the two.
Okay, that's one of those moments where the light goes on because it goes to this formula because, you know, when the president declares that he is the world expert, you know, he's the galaxy brain about something, you know, pretty much all the time he's indicating that he's just making it up or he just heard it or he's just pulling it out of his you know what. But then there's the other side where he goes, no, I've never heard of this guy. You know, the other day he's talking about my home state of Wisconsin. He says, yeah, I don't know anything about their lines. I don't know anything about their voting. Yeah. I love the state. I won the state. Well, okay. Yeah, okay. So I never met him. I never knew him. I'm not responsible at all for any of this stuff. So, you know, this is part of the problem with this guy. So what else? Give me another one of your gems of wisdom.
Well, my pen one, which I wrote in October, was the worse Trump treats you, the better history will treat you. And I think that's that's going to hold up pretty well. The one exception to that that's no longer an exception was Kim Jong-un. And Trump at first in 2017 was pretty mean to Kim, but now they're in love. So I think history will treat Kim pretty badly
for now.
Another one too. The more excuses you make for Trump, the fewer excuses posterity will make for you. These are all from memory. I don't have a list of these in my on my desk, but there are a bunch of these. I think they're pretty.
You may have more faith in history than I do. I agree with you, but that assumes that there is such a thing as history as opposed to all the alternative versions of history that we're going to get, because you know that there are going to be the books written that will in fact embrace this alternative reality, right?
I think it's pretty much true that history is written by the victors, but do you think that the Trump side will win?
No, I don't. I'm just constantly recalibrating what I understand about reality, because I'm actually sitting here thinking in my mind, imagining the history of the last decade by Hugh Hewitt.
What's
going to be like? Oh God! You had another tweet the other day. We'll move past the tweets, but I love this stuff so much that Republicans are pro afterlife.
Yeah.
This is actually, and very succinctly, talking about this party that has characterized itself as pro-life, being willing to go to the mat for the dignity of human life. And it is interesting how quickly, in this particular era, it's like, death is really not that bad. It's like, death is part of life. And we really shouldn't make the cure worse than the disease. Reading some of the rationalizations, look, we've had some head spinning experiences, but this one ranks right up there, doesn't it?
Yeah. And last month, 15 years ago, Terry Schiavo died. And I'm sure you remember that. And I was actually working at Fox News at the time. I was working on Tony Snow's radio show. And I remember how huge that was. And Republicans, they wanted the federal government to intervene, and I think it did. And they wanted President Bush to intervene and all that. And they wanted the government to intervene in the family's decision. And now they don't want the government to do anything to help save preventable, to help save lives when you have preventable deaths. Whereas Terri Schiavo, she was in a vegetative state at the time. And I think the way to understand it, it's not that the Republicans' positions have changed on life and death matters. It makes sense if you conceive of conservatism as an identity and not as an ideology, because they don't really believe
things.
This is
the key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just whatever helps the group. I did too, yeah.
No, this is the point, and we've discussed this on the podcast that for years, folks like me, frankly, thought this was about ideas, it was about policies, and it turns out to be about attitude and about identity, which then explains why so many of the beliefs are can be shed really on a dime. But this one, it's interesting you bring up Terri Schiavo, because that was to say that was big in the conservative world is putting it mildly. I was a radio talk show at the time. We talked about that a lot. We looked at those videos all the time. And the action by the Republicans was extraordinary. Didn't Congress intervene at some point?
Yeah,
This was not just a talking point. I mean, this was the federal government must intervene to save this one woman's life. This one woman's life. This woman who was, there, as you say, in what looked like a vegetative state. And now you open up many of the conservative publications and it's no, absolutely. We need to get the economy back. We can't allow the Dow to crash. Yes, this may mean another 20, 30, 40,000 people die on ventilators, but the cure can't be worse than the disease. And that's wow. That is head snapping. So the pro-life party has become the pro afterlife party. Also, you commented on fraud, and I think it's fascinating watching Donald Trump. And I think this is a huge story, by the way, the fact that Donald Trump is signaling to the Republican Party that they absolutely need to be opposed to any sort of mail-in voting because, of course, that would be rife with fraud. And there's nothing worse than fraud. And what you wrote is the founder of Trump University, who committed tax fraud and who voted by mail himself, says that Americans shouldn't vote by mail, which is horrible and corrupt. Instead, they should take an unproven drug. See, this is one of those, okay, can we just boil it down how absurd the moment is that Donald Trump pretends to be concerned about fraud?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird. In this one instance, he's both a hypocrite and a con man. So, I mean, he has a history of just, you know, a fraud. And I didn't even mention his charities, Trump Foundation. I mean, you only have so many characters on Twitter, so you can't list all of Trump's frauds in one tweet. But so he had the charity, he had Trump University, and also, I mean, his all these failed businesses, and I mean, just where I don't know. So he is just a total con man, and he's acting like he's worried about fraud. And I haven't really looked into it, but I've heard that this stuff about voter fraud is just really overhyped, and. He even admitted it, that he's not really worried about fraud. He's worried about Republicans losing. And he's not even worried about Republicans. He's only worried about Republicans losing because he's worried about going to jail after he's out of office.
Well, that is a point. I'm looking at your other tweet here. In the Trump administration, telling the truth is a fireable offense.
As long as the truth is inconvenient to Trump, yeah.
Stephanie Grisham is quitting a job she never performed, which is true. But let's talk about this voting thing, because this is I'm going to take a deep breath here, because some of the things that Trump says are so transparent. Like, for example, he talks about absentee voting is completely different than mail-in voting, whatever. But that he wants, it's great if senior citizens and members of the military vote by mail, but anybody else would be fraud. In other words, my base should be able to vote by mail, but nobody else. And also saying, if we made it too easy to vote, too many people would vote and we'd never win an election. And I want to step back on all of this, because the question is, do Republicans really want fewer people to vote? Now, I'm one of the people that has pushed back against the notion that Republicans were engaged in wholesale voter suppression for years. Now, I think there's obviously evidence that they did, but I think some of the charges have been exaggerated, but bear with me. On the other hand, there's no question about it that there is this widespread belief that if we make voting too easy, the wrong people will vote and Democrats will win elections, and therefore we shouldn't have that. Now, I can hold these two ideas in my head at the same time, that I actually think that lower vote turnout sometimes is better, because we don't, it's not a great thing to have low information voters voting. I actually like to have voters who know what they're talking about voting, but that's a preference, but it shouldn't be a public policy. Do you understand the distinction I'm making?
That
when you
absolutely
start to have a public policy that specifically makes it hard for people to vote, it is by definition anti-democratic, and it is deeply cynical for Republicans who have gone out of their way to pass one law after another, all of which have the effect of making it more difficult for people to cast their vote to assure a lower vote turnout, not because of some great principle of protecting the integrity of democracy, but because they think that that gives them a partisan advantage. And it seems pretty obvious that's the way it's playing out right now.
Yeah, and even the governor of Florida, maybe 2 months ago, he tweeted that voting was a privilege, not a right. And that's totally insane. But I'm with you. I mean, I don't want low information voters. I want everyone to be high information, So right. it's not that I'm against voting. It's just I want people who vote to know what they're doing. But there is this tendency on the right, and it has been this way for a while, where there's been kind of an anti-democratic ethos, small d democratic ethos. And especially on the libertarian end, where they really, I mean, there's just complete loathing for democracy per se. And when you, I mean, there are books, this German, he's German, but he has this book called Democracy, the God That Failed. And I can't remember, it's Herman Hoppe or something. I can't remember his name, but it also, it makes sense if you think of voter suppression in a larger context, where it's just, it's part of a larger pattern, which is the Republicans' reliance on undemocratic means to further their aims. That's why they're so obsessed with judges, not legislation, but judges. And that's why they love the Electoral College, because they're increasingly worried they can't win the popular vote. They rely on Senate obstruction and foreign interference, too. So all those things. So voter suppression, judges, Electoral College, Senate obstruction, and foreign interference. They've lost confidence in their ability to pass legislation and win elections. So it's part of a larger pattern, I think.
You know, the irony about that is, of course, that was exactly the argument that conservatives made about liberals with the federal judges. I mean, I remember back in the 60s and the 70s and into the 80s that conservatives were arguing that liberals had turned to the courts because they didn't think they could win legislatively. I mean, it's really been turned on its head. And this is one of the reasons why I do think people need to understand why conservatives became so obsessed with the courts, because they thought that the left was going to entrench itself in a federal judiciary or in state judiciaries as well, that would override the will of the public, that would legislate from the bench, and that would create this black-robed oligarchy. So there was a real concern on the right about all this, and now sort of things have been turned around. In fairness, I also just want to point out that I remember when the first when voter ID first became an issue, and I remember hearing about it. I think it felt maybe it was in the early 90s, but I can't remember. And my initial reaction to it was, it seemed just simple common sense that if you want to preserve the integrity of the ballot box, I never imagined that it was going to become the incredible hot button issue that it became. And I think one of the frustrations is that protecting the integrity of the vote should not be a partisan issue. I mean, if there's one thing that we should agree on, it's that everybody that wants to vote should be able to vote, and every vote that is cast is counted, and that we do what we can to prevent votes being stolen or voter fraud. But there doesn't seem to be any kind of, you know, room for all of that, because I'm not sure the debate is taking place in good faith. That's what it comes down to, is, you know, do people really want the democratic process to work? Or do they want to basically keep that thumb on the scale? And I don't know. I don't see an end of that. And I think that November is going to be the potential for it being a train wreck are pretty significant. And I think we saw that in Wisconsin, and we see that being signaled now by the president, who's convinced. And you know, look, I'll tell you, it's deeply ingrained in the conservative base that vote by mail, there's fraud, even though we have millions and millions of people who are voting by mail. So. We're also now continuing to go through the pandemic, with the president saying he's going to open up the country, and that seems to be the window where the president had that somber tone. Notice how the media said, okay, now he's become president, now he's somber, now he gets it. That lasted what, about a week?
If that. But he is so lucky. Our expectations are so low. And this is something else I tweeted, that Trump doesn't get better, our standards get worse. So whenever he does anything semi-normal, he gets adulation from the press. His first State of the Union address, Van Jones,
I remember that.
He was like, "Oh, it's good now." That's a president right there. That's not just his best moment. That's the best moment, or one of the best moments in presidential history, or something. I'm paraphrasing, and it's like, really? He also said that a porn star he called her horse face on Twitter. So when he does stuff like that, if he just doesn't brag about the size of his crowds or his TV ratings in a speech, then it was a really good speech. So if he just acts semi-normal,
the size of his fingers.
Yeah. And if you notice too, when he does these press briefings, he seems so bored when he has to read about the actual, what the press briefings are supposed to be about, when he actually has to read stuff about the pandemic. He could not be more bored. He just wants to get through with that as fast as possible and get on to trashing reporters. That's what he's there for. He really wants to just do that.
This is an important point, because we have become numbed, so that you know, and I use this phrase a lot, you know, an Earth 2.0, a president lying about something of great moment would be a big deal. Now it sometimes doesn't even register. I don't, the Washington Post did a great breakdown of all of the things that he's said at these briefings that don't pan out. You know, he promised that Google was doing this thing and that didn't happen, or the drive-through testing didn't happen. He's promised, you know, one thing after another that was, shall we say, aspirational. And the thing about Trump is there's a certain brazenness about it. Is, yeah, I'm a salesman. I'm going to hype it. I'm going to tell you things to make you feel better that may or may not be true. He really has he really does have sort of the morality and the mentality of the guys that operate Ponzi schemes, right? Well, you know, just keep going, keep moving along. There's just right over, if you make one more investment, you're going to get rich, all of that stuff. Yeah. And yet when you read the accounts, particularly, I know that the cable TV and the networks bear a huge responsibility, and I've ripped them over and over again. But the thing about reading the accounts, sometimes even in the newspapers, it normalizes it, it flattens it out, and go, the president announced X, Y, and Z. And maybe in paragraph 20, it mentions that, well, he also pushed this unproven drug and said these crazy things and, you know, lashed out at somebody and, you know, engaged in some sort of erratic narcissism. But, you know, that's sort of like same old now.
Yeah, I don't know what you're supposed to do with that, because it is so normal. I mean, he's normalizing it because he just does it all the time. And you just kind of, you can't freak out 18 hours a day. So I don't really know how to do that, but I've been reading a lot about narcissism, and they all advise, these books about narcissism, that is the ones that are kind of like self-help books. Basically, they all say just avoid the person, and it's different the person is president, because you have to report on them and try to have to hold them accountable. So there's really no solution other than to get them out of office. But one also key thing I read recently, I think a week or two ago, I read about it. This guy, Eric Fromm, who is a psychoanalyst, wrote about malignant group narcissism. And it makes sense. That's how you kind of understand the cult dynamic of Trumpism, is that his followers, so many of them are kind of wounded. They're wounded individuals. There's something wrong with them. And I don't want to overgeneralize here, because not all of them, but there are certain of them that are just, they kind of feel like losers, and they love, that's, I think that's why they love his winning rhetoric. And when he lashes out at the press, it's, they see, that's how they kind of get back at people who they think are doing better than they are. And Tom Nichols writes about this a lot too, but there is a certain vicarious narcissism going on with him. Mm. And that's why they are so blindly supportive of him.
Okay, I want to talk about a piece that I wrote today, and see whether you think that I have the right balance or not. Because it's difficult sometimes to calibrate how people behave in this era, because none of the rules apply. So I've talked extensively over the last 3 years about the Faustian bargain by Republicans, and the Faustian bargain, pretty obviously, people who make this calculation that, okay, I'm going to go along with all kinds of unacceptable things because, well, I'm going to get certain things. I'm going to get tax cuts. I'll get conservative judges. I'll get regulatory reform. So I'm going to go along with this. I'm going to put my head down. I'm going to tolerate this. I'm going to enable this. And in the Faustian bargain, let's be honest about it. You know, you sell your soul, but you get lots of stuff that you like, right? Money, beautiful women, all kinds of stuff. I assume that a modern Faustian bargain would involve, you know, fast cars and rides on Air Force One and photo ops with Ivanka and something like that. Of course, the problem is you've sold your soul, and the price is way too high for all of that. So you do have this balancing act. But, you know, I wrote about Anthony Fauci and called it the Faucian bargain. And I don't think I invented that, but, you know, not the Fauci, but the Tony Faucian bargain, which is that he knows that he's got to kind of keep his head down. You know, he'll occasionally correct the president, but he can't break with the president. He can't because the bargain is, I'll put up with all of this. I'll have to sit in a room with a crank like Peter Navarro, but I'm still in the room and I can advise the president. Maybe I can get him to listen to me. And so here we're at this moment where we do have these new projections of only 60,000 Americans dying by August. You know, if it wasn't for Dr. Fauci, that number would be a lot worse because he got Trump to listen to him, right? I mean, you know, even maybe temporarily, you know, while Trump's musing about opening the country on Easter, Fauci and the other experts somehow got him to tune out the Hannitys and the other crackpots and say this is serious. So, I mean, maybe they showed him pictures or charts or whatever. And again, it's all going to be temporary. But, you know, this Faucian bargain, at least I think it saved lives in this particular case.
Probably. Well, we don't really know who persuaded Trump. But I do think I've kind of differed with some people who think it's always bad to work for Trump and to, you know, lie for him. I think a lot of ways these people are the real public servants because they are just completely trashing their own legacies and reputations and integrity in order to save lives and in order to help the country, I think. And they're just going to they're just tarnishing their own names. But that's for a larger good, I think. It's hard to know when to stop. But.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And so I think the country is probably better off because James Mattis stuck it out as long as he was. We were better off when he was in the room. Who knows what unknown awfuls he prevented. On the other hand, it's very easy to rationalize these Faustian bargains going along. And then there are the people who've totally trashed, who've just totally sold themselves out, who are complete embarrassments, who I think are going to look awful in history. But you have to distinguish between the people who just totally sold out versus those people who basically kind of took a bullet for the country, but were there at a key moment. And at the moment, this Faucian bargain is holding. Now, it's going to be tested very, very soon because you can tell that the president's back to listening to the, you know, Sean Hannity types of the world. You know, even Tucker Carlson's back saying, hey, maybe this was overhyped. You have Bill Barr, the reliable early indicator of Trump hackery, saying that, you know, by the end of the month, people shouldn't be hiding under their beds anymore. So Fauci's got to decide. I mean, he's threaded the needle so far, but if Trump does decide that he's going to push to reopen the country next month, he's going to have to decide, right? I mean, he's going to have to decide whether or not he wants to stay at the table or whether he's going to speak out.
Yeah, I think he will. Trump will open the country, and I don't know what the health experts are going to do. But he just generally just goes. I mean, if he has the choice between choosing between health experts and between taking their advice and taking the advice of people on Fox News, it seems pretty obvious what he's going to do. I want to ask you why are people like Britt Hume, who tweets constantly about he's trying to underplay the death statistics from COVID-19, why are they so obsessed with that? I mean, at this point, when Trump has already acknowledged it, why are they trying to do that? Do you have any guesses?
Oh, God, this is so depressing. This is, you know, the part of the thing that sort of hangs over you, like what did happen to Brett Hume? Why are they going that way? These are some of the coronavirus truthers and everything. Well, what they're trying to make the case that this has been an overreaction because they think that, in fact, if we don't restart the economy, if we keep doing what we're doing now, Trump won't be reelected. And, you know, honestly, this is like running cover for Trump, that they're, you know, it's sort of like protecting Trump from himself. And part of this will be that when the president reopens the country, they will say, see, this wasn't necessary at all. It isn't that bad. They're already sort of setting up the scenario that even if there are, you know, 90,000 deaths, that's still compare this to the number of people who die of cancer or heart disease, that it's really no big deal. So they're creating this narrative that, in fact, this is not big enough, serious enough to have to shut down the economy. And so, again, they will all rally behind Trump if he reopens the economy, and they will rally behind him, even if this results in an uptick in deaths, because they're already preparing themselves for that.
That's why I think it is such a huge gamble to think, okay, well, maybe we can reopen the economy and there'll be a slight uptick in the Dow or whatever. But that's also, that's assuming that mass death is not going to hurt you, hurt your electoral chances, which I think it would. But, and at that point, the whole country, except for the few million people who watch Fox News, they'll blame that on Trump. They'll say, oh, well, you just sacrifice, you know, thousands of lives to maybe get a better economy. And it just seems bizarre. It's kind of like, okay, well, we're going to risk your life, but here's the good news. You'll be able to afford your own funeral. That's what it seems like. So,
no, I sense a certain amount of panic here. And because this is so grim, but on the other hand, look, it's an interesting moment. You asked about Brit Hume and others. It is an interesting moment how totally obsessed so many people are with looking through everything through the lens of Trumpism. That wasn't well put, but that everything becomes about Trump. You would think that there's a moment where you go, okay, so I really would like to see X candidate elected or X candidate beaten, but we're talking about human lives. I'm not willing to sacrifice my grandma. We are now at this point where, you know, it's, you know, is Brit Hume an expert on medicine or on health or epidemiology? No, what they're doing is they're grasping at things that they think are in the service of Trumpianism, Trumpism, and that's really depressing.
I don't remember this with other Republican presidents, like this sort of obsession with helping Trump. I mean, there wasn't this with Bush or
ever. Or Reagan. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, conservatives like Reagan. I was a big Reagan supporter, but I had no problem in disagreeing with him on X, Y, or Z. There's really no precedent. Actually, this is one of the things that I, and bear with me here, what I like about Joe Biden is that Joe Biden is so obviously flawed that there's not going to be a cult of personality. I think there would have been a cult of personality around Bernie or some of these other folks. But
or
I think
Warren, probably.
I think you're right about that. But Biden is like, okay, he's Uncle Joe. Let's put him in there. But I'm not gonna be writing, you know, articles or doing podcasts about, you know, the great leader. Oh my God, you know, he is the what? No, just do your job. It sort of takes things down to a normal level as opposed to what we're at here. But I have to say that, and you've watched this as well, this disorienting transformation of the conservative movement, and watching guys like Brit Hume, who. Look, I mean, a decade ago, I thought Brit Hume was a completely rational, reasonable guy, right? He's somebody who would have been a go-to pundit that I would have taken very, very seriously. And now he's so totally invested in all of this. And he also, you're starting to see this other thing. I think I alluded to it a little bit earlier. The argument that, well, if there's only 60,000 deaths, this proves that we didn't need to do any of this stuff. I mean, that makes sense in their heads. You know that? Because of course, if we hadn't done any of these, what would the numbers be like? I mean, and this is the internal contradiction, because what Trump is going to say will be, look, the number of deaths are down because of all the things I did. Now, by the way, he didn't do them. States and local governments did them, but he's going to take credit for lowering the death rate. But then so many people in his cult are going to say, but see, you didn't need to do that in the first place. And those two ideas will somehow be, I don't know. They will somehow subsume the contradiction.
This is why I think the thinking of it as a cult is not a stretch. Even people who aren't, you know, really cultists, they don't really go through the logic of it, and it's because they don't want to arrive at the logical conclusions of their own thinking, and. And it's kind of, it reminds, this is, you know, you and I like to quote Hannah Arendt a lot. And in her book, The Origins of Totalitarianism, she writes about the infallibility of the leader, where the leader can never admit that he's wrong, and neither can his lieutenants and all down through the movement. And that is exactly what has happened with Trump. And the reason is because he's such a narcissist. So his narcissism has enabled his authoritarianism, which has created this kind of cultish atmosphere. And my favorite example is the, do you remember the Kansas City tweet when he said that Kansas City was in Kansas?
Oh, this God, yeah. Yeah.
And Matt Schlapp was defending Trump's tweet even after he deleted it.
Yeah.
Even after he deleted it. And he was saying, hey, attention, East Coast elitists, Kansas City is in Kansas. And that's a level of hackery I've never seen.
No, Matt Schlapp is sort of defined.
You're defending his mistakes even after he kind of conceded it. And it's basically the dear leader is always right, especially when he's wrong. That's the mentality of the Trumpists.
Well, and Hannah Arendt also anticipated that was that having annihilated the concept of truth, that even when people realized that the great leader had lied, they were willing to accept that because this was a sign of their cleverness. This is very much and Limbaugh plays this out. Well, of course, Trump didn't mean what he said.
Yeah,
he was doing it because he was playing the three or four dimensional chess. Okay, so I want to read you a quote.
Scott Adams really does.
Oh God. Oh, he's amazing. Yeah. Okay, I want to read you a quote because I know that you're a student of Hannah Arendt, and this really hit me. Now, this is not Arendt, but okay. What is the cost of lies? It is not that we'll mistake them for the truth. The real danger is that if we hear enough lies, then we no longer recognize the truth at all. What can we do then? What else is left but to abandon even the hope of truth and content ourselves instead with stories? In these stories, it doesn't matter who the heroes are. All we want to know is who is to blame. Now, that is clearly channeling Hannah Arendt, isn't it? I mean, it's almost word for word from Hannah Arendt, right?
Yeah. Who is that?
Okay. That is the quote from the HBO series Chernobyl. They put that in the in the mouth of the chief scientist, Valery Legasov. And he's talking about the way that they handled the Chernobyl disaster. And I thought, wow, you know, now we're seeing how the theoretical discussion of the annihilation of truth in Hannah Arendt's books play out in real life. Here is exactly how it played out. And of course, when I watch Chernobyl, I'm thinking, well, this is a commentary on Soviet society, but you watch the way the pandemic is playing out and all of the misinformation and all of the lies. And it connects the dots.
The scary thing about Trump is he is such a liar that it's even people who support him and even who acknowledge that he lies, he has spread so much cynicism through the country that even people who support him just say, well, everyone lies. All politicians are liars. They're all scumbags. And I would say all politicians lie some of the time, but they don't all lie all of the time. And Trump lies all the time, and he lies about the dumbest things. And he'll contradict himself. There's a story in the New York Times 2 days ago, I think, where he contradicted himself within 16 minutes about the World Health Organization. So
yeah,
it's just
off
kind
funds
of
for the World Health Organization.
And there's a term for that. It's kind of I read this in this book called The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, where it's hedonism, present moment hedonism, where you do or say whatever you think helps you in the moment. And he really, it's like what New Age spiritualists say, like live in the moment, but he really does it.
Okay. Is there a part of you that feels exhausted by all of this? Because I feel like we've been saying this now for three years, including the fact that truth matters, which seems now to be kind of a cliche, but also that one of the reasons why you should not lie all the time is that sooner or later, you're going to want your credibility. You will need your credibility. And here that moment has come. And so those of us who've been saying, look, the guy's a con man. He's an serial exaggerator. He is he's an obsessive fabulous. You know, now it really matters. I'm struggling not to sort of like throw up my hands on all of this because, you know, yes, we need to reopen the country. We need to put people back to work. It's an incredibly delicate moment. But right now, you know, how many Americans really believe, I mean, well, in fact, we know what the numbers are. It's not a matter of polls, but can an honest person believe this president? Can you believe that the information that they're giving out is accurate? Can you believe the decisions they're making are in good faith? Because this is a life or death matter. And there's no way that Trump gets back his credibility. There's no way that he unlights this bonfire. And, you know, that this country should be able to get through all of this. We should be able to handle all of this. But we have the worst man leading the country at the worst possible moment.
I think that's exactly why he doesn't want to deal with this crisis, why he hasn't, why he downplayed it so much is because he knows in order to deal with it, he would have to be honest and would have to tell the truth. And in a real crisis is something he cannot control. And if you, I immediately thought of his whole thing with the Mexican caravans, which is just a manufactured crisis, a fabricated crisis. And and it's not that he dislikes crises per se, because Trump wants people to be alarmed when they shouldn't be alarmed, and he wants them to be afraid when they shouldn't be afraid. It's always the opposite with him. And the reason why he doesn't like this crisis, the pandemic, is because he can't control it. Facts are too powerful, and he wants it to just go away. He wants to pretend it doesn't exist, because it's real problems require real solutions, which requires real work. And it also requires honesty. You actually have to deal with it. So he just wants to pretend like it's not a real problem, and he will make up.
Oh, okay, but here's the good real problem. Yeah, but here's the good news. Here's the good news, though, right? Is that there's a lot of concern about, you know, here we have an emergency that is a moment where a wannabe authoritarian can radically expand their power. And, you know, be honest about it, you know, Trump has overridden a lot of our democratic norms, but he really has not used all of his powers. And this is where you have a piece coming out over the weekend in the Los Angeles Times that actually makes, I think, a really important point, that subverting democracy requires more effort than Trump is willing to exert. That the one thing we have working for us is that Trump just doesn't want to do what it takes to become a dictator, right?
Yeah, I think he wants,
he doesn't have the work
power, yet. But he wants power, but he doesn't want to have to work to get it. And there's a quote that David Frum said in an interview once, where he said that Trump is needy first, greedy second, and authoritarian third. Look at these other strongmen, and they're all extremely determined, and they really work to get to, you know, take over a state. And Trump, he subverts the rule of law in order to cover up his crimes. He doesn't care about controlling the Department of the Interior. I mean, so he's not really interested in controlling a country the way other dictators are. He's just too lazy. And Axios did got some private information somehow. And the 3 months after the midterm elections, he spent 60% of his time in executive time. So, and the time he was awake. So he spent that executive time is when he just watches TV, tweets, and just chats with friends on the phone. 60% of his time he did that. That's just complete laziness.
Yeah.
And I say in the piece too, it's kind of like how he inherited a fortune. He just wants to inherit an autocracy. He does not want to have to work for it. And so, yeah.
Well, and another one of the Windsor Man aphorisms, to be a successful strong man, you need a strong work ethic. Trump only has weak ethics. So I suppose that's a glimmer of hope. My fear going forward is that in a second term, when he begins to figure out what he can get away with, and he's surrounded himself with guys like Bill Barr, you know, how far he can push that. But yeah, the one thing that we have had going for us has been his incompetence and his total indifference to the actual act of governing. So Windsor Man, I have enjoyed your work for years. We've never spoken, we've never met, so I really appreciate the fact that we've had a chance to have this conversation.
Likewise, I'm a huge fan of yours, Charlie, and thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, it's great to talk.
I appreciate it. And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. Have a happy holiday weekend and a happy Easter. We'll be back again, and we'll do this all over again on Monday.